radio. The medium is the message.
From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
Any eight-year-old child can write a small program of 10 or 20 program statements. The Star Wars system, had it ever been built, would have been 100 million lines of code.
From satellites to banking to announcements for the next PTA bake sale, it seems everything runs on computer software. And most of that software is written by American computer programmers. On this show, Moira first speaks with Ed Yourdon, creator of the Yourdon Method of Structured System Development, and author of the book, The Decline and Fall of the American Programmer. And what about the quality of these American computer programs?
If we go back to the Hubble telescope, for example, if there had been an overall end-to-end test of the entire system, that problem with the lens would have been detected immediately. On the other hand, that's a very expensive process.
That's Peter Neumann, principal scientist in the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International. He writes the monthly column, Inside Risks, and has spent years analyzing the problems which have been found in technology systems. And now, here's Moira with Ed Yourdon.
You have committed yourself to a tenfold improvement in software development technology by the mid-1990s. Why?
Well, if we don't, somebody else will do it to us, and there are a lot of jobs at risk. I think this is a goal that the leading-edge organizations all around the world are setting for themselves.
What is the state of American software development technology?
Well, the best description, I guess I would say, is that it's variable. I mean, it ranges from the very good to the very bad and everything in between, with very little consistency. Ironically, things tend to go in sort of a pendulum shift back and forth, and with the advent of the personal computer over the last 10 years, there's been a movement back toward the sort of cowboy mentality that we used to see in the mainframe days early on in the 1960s. And that's particularly evident in Silicon Valley, I might add.
You wrote the book, The Decline and Fall of the American Programmer. Have American computer programmers fallen down and they can't get up?
It's not so much that they've fallen down. They never got up to begin with. There's been great emphasis on creativity and doing really interesting things with computers. But the software industry, I think, for the last 30 years has been delivering its products to a marketplace, both internally within corporations as well as outside to the marketplace, but a marketplace that would basically take anything that that the software people felt like giving them, very much like the automobile industry up until the early 1970s. Whatever they did was pretty much okay. So it's not so much that things have gotten worse, but rather that things haven't gotten any better, except that in the last 5 or 10 years there's now begun to be some competition from industries around the world that think they can do better.
You describe world-class software. What is world-class software?
World-class software is software that's developed on time, plus or minus a couple of percent, within the budget that was originally allocated, with the number of people that were originally assigned, and software that works as specified without any errors in it.
There's a whole bunch of people out there right now going, good work, Ed. Yeah, does that happen?
It doesn't happen very often. That's the problem. The average software project in the United States is 1 year late and 100% over budget. And it's not that we're missing things by 5 or 10%. That wouldn't be a big problem. But when somebody asks for a new payroll system or something of that sort and initially conceives it to be a six-month project for $10,000 and finds that it's 12 months rather than 6 months and twice what the original budget was, that really gets people rather upset.
Right. There's been a lot of meetings in which the software people said it's 98% done.
Yep.
Every week for...
Yep, starting from the second day of the project usually.
That's right. How critical is software to any American business?
Oh, at this point, if you pull out the software, you basically shut the business down. Most organizations, large and small, need the software for all of their day-to-day operations, for their accounting work and for to keep their customers, and for more and more of them, just to literally run the business on a minute-by-minute basis. There have been a number of famous examples over the last year of airline reservation systems going down, and basically the airline itself shuts down. In general, a large American organization anywhere in the world that loses its software finds that that within a week or so it's basically out of business.
Why do so many business people regard programming as black magic?
Because it was black magic early on. In the early days, it was very difficult to get any software to work. It involved skills that were really basically not known to most other people, and the software industry has tended to perpetuate that sort of witchcraft aura. So that the other thing that happens that's almost as bad is the business people who learn how to write little tiny programs and conclude that it's really very simple. And these things, unfortunately, scale up exponentially. Any you know, 8-year-old child can write a small program, and you know, they do in school these days, of 10 or 20 program statements. 100 program statements is also trivial. 1,000 starts to get a little bit more difficult, but it's not that hard for someone who's had some practice. When you get up to 10,000 or 100,000, then it's tough. Airline reservation systems and big things like that are 1 million or 2 or 3 million. The Star Wars system, had it ever been built, would have been 100 million lines of code. And that's almost beyond human comprehension, unfortunately.
So you can't just sit down and whip it out over the weekend?
No. No.
Even
no.
If you had a plan.
No, and in fact, one of the interesting things is that at a certain threshold, you get beyond the point that any person, genius or not, can do it alone. If it's up to 100,000 lines of code, you know, a very clever person might be able to sit in a corner for a month or two and get it done. When you get up to 1 million, you're bound to have an army of people, and 10 million, it's a very large army, and it gets worse and worse.
Wages for computer programmers in some area of the world are incredibly low, and when an American company seeks to take economic advantage of this cheap labor, how does it go about it?
In a variety of ways. You know, at the moment, the average American software engineer typically makes something on the order of $50,000 or $60,000 a year. And in several of the developing nations, we're looking at salaries 5 or 6 or even 10 times lower. So there's a great deal of attrition. I mean, we're not just looking for a 10% or 20% savings, but a factor of 5 or 10. There are basically three ways that an American company would take advantage of it. One is the form of outsourcing that we've heard about mostly up to this point in terms of operations. Rather than having your actual computer room and all of the equipment on-site in the United States, it can be outsourced away from your company to, these days, almost anywhere. But you can outsource the software development as well. Rather than hiring 100 programmers in downtown San Francisco or New York at rather astronomical salaries, plus rent, plus all the overhead and so on, you can simply hire 100 programmers in India or Bangalore or Ireland or any place of that sort. If you're nervous, you can bring those programmers over here. And then you lose some of the economic advantage because you're looking at expensive travel costs and all the visa problems and so on. Once you've gotten used to working with this offshore supplier of software, then the next software project could be done on-site, you know, in the developing country. Where you tend to preserve all those economic benefits. So that's the sort of thing that's going on a lot these days. Some of the multinational open up subsidiary or a department or whatever, wherever they think they can get good cheap labor. Several of the American insurance companies, for example, decided that Hartford was too expensive, so they just opened up their software departments in Ireland. They've got English as the native language. They've got salaries 3 times lower than American salaries. They've got fairly good telecommunications. And they've got a great deal of government support, subsidies and tax breaks and so on. Several of the computer companies, IBM, Microsoft, Texas Instruments, DEC, several others, have opened up programming shops in India. Now, there you've got slightly more difficult telecommunication problems, but you still have the English language, and you've got even more attractive salary benefits, so it's not that hard to do these days.
Is that counted in the percentage or their wedge of the pie when we say this much of the software developed is American software? Is that counted on the American side or the export side?
Well, I don't know. That's pretty fuzzy. I haven't ever seen any public statements about how much of the software is developed here or there or anywhere else. I mean, I don't think that's really adequately accounted for, even in things like automobiles, which have parts from all over the world, but that's been kind of an invisible phenomenon so far as I've been able to tell with software. If you're talking about software products, a shrink-wrapped product, then it's fairly obvious to tell whether it came from overseas or in this country. But if IBM is developing some software internally and half their programmers are here and half of their programmers are somewhere else, who's to know? Anderson Consulting, for example, has a consulting and software practice that I think represents about $2 billion a year in revenue. And large chunks of that are done outside the United States. They have a huge software factory in Manila. And again, with good telecommunications and a good infrastructure, it's not at all hard to do.
In your book, you say that more than 50% of the U.S. computer science PhD students these days are foreign nationals. What do you make of this?
That's not unique to computer science. That's true, I think, in general of engineering fields. We have a very good educational system in this country at the upper levels. There's a lot of debate, obviously, about whether elementary schools are teaching reading and writing properly, but I think most of the developing countries and even the advanced countries like Japan feel that we have excellent undergraduate and graduate level university resources. So for electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and a whole bunch of other things, including software, there's been a trend over the last 10 or 20 years to send people here, and that's particularly evident in the computer field. Because although we'll discuss this, I'm sure, later on about whether creativity and innovation are really the key issues, certainly we do have that reputation for doing very innovative, very leading-edge, wonderful stuff in the software field. So a lot of these other countries would like to send their best and brightest students over here to pick it up at the Berkeleys and Stanfords and Carnegie Mellons and MITs and so on. Some of them stay, but a lot of them for financial reasons or loyalty reasons or family reasons or whatever go back home to take all that knowledge to their home country.
I'm always very uncomfortable talking about protectionist or isolationist policies, but along this line, can or should governments protect their software industries?
I don't know whether they can. I have a personal bias against it as well. Into Pandora's all sorts of problems. But again, if it's been difficult to do with something as well-known as automobile manufacturing, I think you'd have an even more difficult job with something as abstract and amorphous and intellectual as software development. It's awfully tough to put that inside a box and wrap it up and keep it inside the United States. There may be a variety of things that government policies could do to encourage more research or better practices or so on in the United States to make us more competitive, but to try to lock the door and keep other nations from bringing their software in would be pretty tough, I think.
Will you quote Capers Jones, software would not be the only high technology occupation where the United States lost out due to misunderstanding the ground rules of international competition. In your mind, what are the ground rules of international competition?
Well, there are several, but they really boil down to, I think, two or three critical factors. One of them is productivity and several forms of that. The whole business marketplace these days obviously is moving very, very quickly. You've got to get products out and developed and into the marketplace as fast as possible. And as we were discussing a few moments ago, a lot of the products that we build today depend very, very dramatically on software. If you can't get the software working, then you can't get the new widget product that you're building into the marketplace. If the software guys are 6 months behind schedule, you're dead. So to be an international competitor, you've got to be able to develop software fast. You've got to be able to develop it economically, which means that you've got to get fewer people capable of developing more software more quickly at a lower cost. And in the long run, I really believe that the most dominant issue is going to be one of quality. You've got to be able to develop a software product that works, that doesn't fall apart because of bugs or software defects. And that's one area that I think the American software industry is almost totally ignorant of. There's a general sense that it would be nice if we could do things faster and cheaper and so forth, but there's a cultural notion that bugs are inevitable, that if we develop a large, complicated software program, of course it's going to have bugs in it. In fact, the very use of the word bug is indicative that we're talking about an independent life form that somehow creeps into our programs all by itself. If you listen to programmers talking, you'll hear an entire taxonomy of bugs. There are big bugs and little bugs, live bugs, dead bugs, good ones, bad ones. There are dead bugs that you've killed them. There are deep bugs that are, buried down in the software, and you can't find them very, very easily at all. It's this amazing sort of culture that presumes that We don't know how the bugs got into the software, but we'll do our darndest to get them out, but it's inevitable that they'll be there. The Japanese mentality is just the opposite. They refer to bugs as spoilage, and it's something for which the programmers take personal responsibility. If a bug is discovered in their software, they are not allowed to go home until it's fixed. But even more, they are required to write long reports on how the bug got into the program in the first place. Who did it? How did it happen? You know, what did we do wrong that caused this bug to get in there? And how can we change the manufacturing process to prevent it from happening again? Which is the same thing they've done with most of their other manufacturing industries. And that's the world-class mentality, to say, you know, we've got to think of this as a manufacturing process that we can improve so that we have, you know, a higher and higher likelihood of turning out software that has no errors in it at all.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Ed Yordan, creator of the Yordan Method for Structured Systems and author of The Decline and Fall of the American Programmer. You mentioned quality of the American software product, and you're talking about finding bugs. Yet you can go all the way through a bachelor's and a master's and a PhD degree and never take a single course in testing. When I brought it up, I've seen some otherwise staid professors feel pretty challenged about it. Am I being unduly concerned here?
Well, the concern is a legitimate concern when you're looking across the board at the American educational system, the university-level educational system. You're right. It's a great concern. And there are a variety of reasons for this. The most common form of computer education in American universities revolves around computer science. And that's fine when you're thinking of new theories and new ways of developing computer programs. Maybe the issue of testing and debugging and so forth doesn't you know really rise to the top. But there are other universities now that are really focusing on software engineering. You know, just as engineers like to build bridges that don't fall down, and they have to worry about how can we be confident of that. Software engineers have to worry about how to build well-engineered software that's not going to fall over. And there are a few universities that do excellent work in this area. One of the real gurus in this whole field of software is a gentleman by the name of Harlan Mills, recently retired from IBM. And he and some of his colleagues have done some teaching at the University of Maryland, where I don't think they call it a computer science class. I think it's more appropriately titled software engineering. But there are no exams in the course. There are no papers in the course. There's no homework in the course. There's only one thing. You have to write a program by the end of the semester. And it's a pass-fail course. It's all or nothing. And the entire grade is based on this one program, which has to either work or not work the first time. You turn in your program, and you're not even allowed to compile or assemble your program. And the professor will attempt to compile your program to see whether it's correct, and will then try a whole suite of test cases on your program. And if your program works, you get an A. If it doesn't work, for whatever reason, you flunk. End of story. And that's the real world in terms of the way software works, and that's a pretty tough pill to swallow for some of these students. But the majority of them actually pass.
The way it is at NASA. Put that ignition switch, it had better fly.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So there are some very good schools and some very knowledgeable and dedicated professors who are I think doing some very good work in this area. But in general, the academic world isn't in sync with what's going on in industry at all.
So it's starting to come around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's starting to improve.
You talk about observing the energy level of the average programmer. What have you observed, and what does that mean?
Well, the average programmer doesn't work in Silicon Valley for Apple Computer or Microsoft or, any of these razzle-dazzle places that you tend to think about. The average programmer, unfortunately, works for a commercial Fortune 500 company, a bank or an insurance company or a widget manufacturing company, where the essence of the business is not software. They're in the widget business or the banking business or the whatever business. Computers are generally considered part of the overhead of the organization, and the computer programmers are considered a lesser form of life that are generally a pain in the neck, or, you know, even worse. and they're surrounded by bureaucracy, surrounded by the need to fill out lots of pieces of paper. In the Defense Department, for example, Capers Jones, whom we mentioned earlier, has pointed out that there's a requirement, the Defense Department requirement, for 400 English words of documentation for every program statement of software. So you're just overwhelmed with paperwork and documentation and bureaucracy and so on. And as a result, the you know, the energy level is not very good. It's, you know, it's the sort of energy level that you would expect to see in the post office or in you know, a typical civil service job. And that's part of the problem, because the software industry in some of these developing nations has a much higher energy level. These people are out to eat our lunch, and it's a tremendous opportunity for them because it requires almost no capital investment. You know, a programmer in Singapore or Manila or India, all he has to do is buy a PC, and he can be in the software business.
So if you're a CEO or a company president or a manager, whether you're in the public or the private sector, and look over there at that group of kind of lethargic programmers, what do you do? How do you change?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that some of this has begun changing since I wrote my book and published it last spring. Actually, I did the writing about a year earlier than that. And the big change over the last couple of years, which every CEO is aware of, is the downsizing trend. Every CEO in the land is trying to figure out some way to get rid of his mainframes and everything associated with his mainframes, all of his programmers, all of his managers, all of his incredibly expensive overhead. Now, they tend to go overboard with that in some cases. They throw out the baby with the bathwater, and they bring in PCs and people who may not necessarily know how to operate them very well or program them very well. But that has turned out to be the immediate threat that a lot of American software people have responded to in the last year or two. You know, when I talk to a lot of programmers and say, you better watch out because some programmer in India is going to take your job, they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, India's, you know, a long ways away and it'll never happen to me. But when I say, you better watch out because your CEO is going to throw out your mainframe, they say, yes, you're right. I better learn how to program on a PC. I better learn how to be much more responsive. I better stop telling the user community it's going to take 2 years to do this simple program, because if I don't, you know, change my ways, I'm going to be out of a job. You know, there's a lot of blood on the floor in the big Fortune 500 DP departments. It's very brutal.
I've always held that just about anyone can learn the technology of software development, just like anyone can learn to cook. He's not cringing here, so he must be all right there.
I can't learn to cook.
Okay. Other than that, the Moira Gunn structured cooking method, it'll take off. Given that a person can learn and practice the trade, what are the traits mark a successful programmer?
Well, a lot of this, as I was mentioning earlier, has to do with scale. And a lot of it, since I might as well address the strongest kind of disagreement with this whole theme of mine, a lot of it may or may not have to do with the issue of creativity and innovation. If you ask the typical American programmer, particularly in the Silicon Valley area, what characterizes a good programmer, you'll hear a lot of talk about cleverness and innovation and, you know, inventing, you know, wonderful programs that have never been seen before on the planet. And there's a lot to be said for that. A lot of the wonderful stuff that's come out of the micro and PC industry over the last 10 years has been very much a function of just the innovative, creative culture that, you know, that Americans pride themselves on. That's fine. But there's a lot of mundane, run-of-the-mill, and also large, complex software applications that American businesses need to just run their job, where the key characteristics are precision and a formal, rigorous process. If you're going to cook for one person and make it an innovative meal, that requires one set of skills. If you're going to cook a sit-down dinner for an Army 300, you better have a very good recipe, and you better follow it to the letter, because you're dealing with large quantities of ingredients, and if you screw up, you're going to cook a bad meal for a lot of people.
And 300 people are going to be mad at you.
Yeah, 300 people are going to be mad at you, and you're not going to have time to do it over again. Whereas if you're cooking for one person, and it turns out that your creative concoction is an hour late, well, that's all right. If it turns out that it really wasn't very good, oh, that's okay, throw it out and do it again. But when the numbers, you know, 100 people or 1,000 people, and when you can't afford to be wrong, you know, when you're serving dinner to the president, it's a different game. And I think that's where the real cultural problem is in terms of our American software people. We have some extraordinarily clever people who have built some extraordinarily wonderful, innovative applications, especially on the micros and PCs. But when you're building a system to monitor the automated teller machines nationwide, it's a different set of skills. And interestingly, the Asian and European cultures are often better acclimated to that because they tend to operate through consensus. They're more willing to follow instructions and do things by the book, and they take longer to do it sometimes, but they get the job done right.
I hear so much excitement about object-oriented programming and how it's the savior for the future, and it looks to me just like another natural step in the evolution of program design techniques. Can you explain to our listeners, what is object-oriented programming, and is all this excitement really justified?
Explaining object-oriented development, I'll see whether I can do that in 25 words or less. It's based on the idea of organizing software components, the chunks of software, as closely as possible to the things in the real world that the software is trying to interact with or control or communicate with and so on. In the old days, we used to organize our software based on something called functional decomposition. We would first try to imagine what's the software going to do, what's the job or the function of the software, and then we would break that down into smaller pieces. And then another little camp went off in the corner and said we should organize the software based on the data that it's going to be interacting with and break the data down into smaller pieces. The object-oriented community has said that if you look in the real world, you'll find humans and pencils and telephones and a variety of objects which are typically characterized by both data and function. If you look at any real-world object, it has some attributes, color, size, weight, shape, and so on, and particularly if it's an animate object, a cat or a dog or a person or whatever, it has behavior. It can run, it can walk, and it can respond, it can send messages to other objects and so on. And so the object-oriented software approach is based on that idea that that the individual pieces of software that we use as our building blocks should be pieces that have descriptive data as well as the technical term is methods, functional behavior. We then take advantage of another very familiar concept from our normal human activity called inheritance. We know that children inherit a lot of their properties from their parents, who in turn inherit their properties from their grandparents. We tend to classify all of our knowledge and all of the things that we deal with in the same fashion. We have, you know, the class of animal, and then below that we have the subclasses of vertebrate and invertebrate animals and so on. And it's a wonderful way to organize something that would otherwise be very complicated, and the object-oriented approach tries to do the same thing.
Moira's first guest has been Ed Yurden, author of the book The Decline and Fall of the American Programmer. It's published by Yurden Press, a division of Prentice Hall. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. Peter Neumann is a principal scientist in the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International. With over 40 years of experience in technology systems, he writes the monthly column Inside Risks, documenting the problems which are found in technology systems.
We've been talking with Ed Yurden about American computer software, and he feels that American computer software is not the quality it ought to be. Peter, how bad is the state of American software and technology and systems in general?
Well, I think we have to step back a little bit. The state of software as a whole, whether it's European or Japanese or American, is not really what it ought to be. There's an enormous difference between writing a little program for a PC, maybe a little query by example thing, or maybe it's a little spreadsheet program on one hand, and writing a system with maybe 10 million lines of code or 60 million lines of code or something on that order of magnitude that is going to be responsible for maintaining the health and safety of a very large number of individuals, or that is going to be responsible for keeping a large amount of information in a reasonable state. That means secure, reliable, high integrity, that the data is actually correct, And when you're building a system that has very critical requirements, the name of the game is totally different from that which one runs into when one is merely writing a little PC program.
So it doesn't matter if you're writing a simple PC program that has some nice small side effect like producing a little mailing list for you so you don't have to do that every month versus the kind of programming that's life critical.
That's partly true. And then there's also the question of what is this computer system doing? We have a bunch of stories of mailing list programs that either failed and produced horrendous mistakes in addressing or that were in fact compromised. There are two stories of congressional computer systems that were broken into from outside and the labeling system was altered rather radically and the mailing lists were destroyed. So again, it's not just a question of does it work right, but does it work right in the face of malicious attacks, in the case of the mailing label things? Does it work right in the face of normal problems with the hardware failing? Does it work properly in certain critical environments where you might have lightning strikes or power failures? In a hospital environment where if the system goes down, you're going to lose a lot of patients if, in fact, they are connected in a life-critical way.
Well, given that, how do we tell how good the software is or the system is?
Now I think you've hit the real nub of the problem. There is no real way to guarantee that the system is any good. We have examples of systems that have gone on for 6, 7, 8, 9 years with no major disasters, and all of a sudden, a line of code that was written years ago is suddenly executed, and that line of code might never have been executed before because something unusual happened. And the problem is that we have to anticipate all of the unusual circumstances that might arise. And the average programmer is never oriented toward doing that. The person who is writing, say, software for a fly-by-wire aircraft system might worry a lot more about that. If what happens if this system suddenly gets into a funny state, what will happen to the aircraft? Or a nuclear reactor, for example, or something of that nature, where there are a lot of lives at stake. And the problem is, how do you know that that system will do what it's supposed to do essentially all of the time? The answer is you can't. And there are all sorts of things that we can do in the computer profession in terms of some of the things Ed Yorden was describing, for example, in better methodologies for software development and in testing and in diagnosis and in maintenance properties and operational routines for carrying out, say, software maintenance in some sane way. Because every time you change a line of code, you have potentially undermined the entire system, as was shown in the case of the telephone system collapse when a three-line code patch was put in that hadn't been tested thoroughly. Now, even if you have tested it thoroughly, you still don't know that it's going to do the right thing. And in the research community, there's all sorts of work on formal methods and sort of mathematical proofs of correctness, which can, in fact, in certain cases, greatly increase your assurance that the system will do the right thing. But the bottom line is that you will never know that the system will do the right thing.
Yeah. It will likely do the right thing after all these exercises, but you just don't know environmentally what's going to happen.
That's right.
Software and computers are viewed as these black boxes. And I remember decades ago, I sat in front of my family's little black and white TV inside a very large mahogany cabinet, I like to point out, and with great anticipation, we watched the countdown of an unmanned rocket, but it was wonderful. And seconds before ignition, the countdown stopped, and Walter Cronkite looked sort of alarmed. And then he listened in his earpiece, and he said in that, you know, so recognizable Walter Cronkite voice, we were all looking, and he said, apparently, the computer broke. Now, while this was long before I had anything to do with computers, it wasn't very satisfying. I mean, I wanted to know what happened. You know, did the lights go out? Did the doors fall off? You know, what does that mean, the computer broke? But getting back to the black box magic aspect, should an everyday person expect that an explanation can be made and that it's an explanation they can understand when they hear about these failures?
I don't think so. if you go back to the very first shuttle launch, there was this timing glitch in the software where the backup system was not synchronized properly with the primary four computers. And it's something that had worked always in all the testing that they'd ever done before that. It took them quite a while to analyze the thing and figure out what had gone wrong, because it wasn't at all obvious. In some cases, it takes days to figure out what the problem was. In some cases, it's immediately obvious because the programmer is sitting there and he suddenly realizes that he forgot a character or a sign or something like that, an inversion maybe. And he'll slap his head hard and say, wow, I forgot. Boy, I really goofed that one.
That decimal point.
But in many cases, the nature of the problem is so subtle on the face of it that it takes quite a while to find it.
I remember when there was the problem with the Hubble telescope. And one thing that really impressed me is I was listening to my public radio station, and there was a live broadcast of speeches being made in Congress at that point. And one congressman after another got up and indignantly said, how could they do this, and I can't believe, and you know. And yet I didn't hear one person standing up who seemed to have any comprehension of how technology was developed. And yet we depend on them to make the right choices and to ensure that the right amount of money is provided to the right systems people to make sure that this happens, the space program goes forward, technology goes forward. How much does a person in Congress need to know to understand the situation?
Well, let's generalize it to people outside of Congress as well as people inside of Congress. What's happening is that in order to survive in this world, you need a great deal of technological literacy. The concept of the black box that you've alluded to is sort of a concept of virtual reality where everything just works fine and you don't have to worry what's inside the black box. In order to realize why you have a problem, you need to understand how the system works. If there's a credit card problem, you have to understand why they are telling you that, I'm sorry, the computer can't do this. It is not that the computer can't do it, it's that just somebody either doesn't know how to do it or that the program simply ignored that particular case, but it could easily have done it had it been programmed properly. So there are many issues here that require a great deal of understanding and knowledge and experience, and perhaps your program is heading in that direction. But I think as far as Congress is concerned, if they have the attitude that they can treat everything as a black box, they're in real trouble, because they simply cannot understand the depth of the problems without having been exposed to them. As we walk through, for example, the years and years of disasters that have occurred in dealing with computers, we see that the same kinds of mistakes are made over and over again in somewhat different contexts. But the people who did the original system are no longer around. One of the problems when you're dealing with a system with 10 million lines of code is that you never want to do it again. And a lot of the people who have been through an effort like that simply go off and do other things with their lives, so that some of the lessons that have been gained get lost. Another thing is that there's a wonderful book by Henry Petrosky, who's a civil engineer at Duke, To Engineer is Human. And he talks about how we don't ever learn anything from our successes, but we have an opportunity to learn from our failures. So it's very important to really take a look at the failures and figure out what's happened. And I think Congress sort of assumes in the abstract that computers are black boxes and communication systems are black boxes, and they should work properly. But in fact, they don't.
They don't.
And we really have to spend a lot more effort in figuring out why they don't work the way they're supposed to.
What are the different stages in developing where errors or potential failures can get introduced?
Oh, this is an enormous range. The first thing is deciding on whether you really should put a computer in the system or not. In the nuclear power, for example, the system is fairly complicated, but I think a lot of the people in the field have felt that putting a computer in line in the control would make it even less reliable. So the modern systems tend to use computers for the automatic shutdown system, but not necessarily for the control systems themselves. And so the first decision is, should you really put a computer into a particular application? If you do, what have you done to the situation? Have you suddenly created a problem for yourself that if the computer should fail, you do not have a fail-safe mode in your design, and you might kill a very large number of people? The second thing is, of course, is once you've decided to go ahead and do it, you've got to have the requirements right for the system. And if we look through the archives of the risks cases that I've collected, many cases where they didn't get the requirements right in the first place. In the case of say, the Patriot, the requirements said that the system only has to run for 14 hours. And that may be correct for the application that was originally intended, but it might be rather short-sighted if you then decide that you have to run the system for longer periods of time. So it's not just a question of requirements not being correct. It's a question of there being not quite far-sighted enough.
Bound for failure.
Yeah, and we often don't anticipate that once we've designed this wonderful system, it's going to be used for many other purposes. So we tend to design things that are somewhat narrowly conceived, whereas if you'd step back at the beginning and said, well, look, let's generalize a little bit. We can make it more reliable. We can make it more resistant to malicious attack. We can make it able to respond to its own failures and recover from them and maybe reconfigure itself and wind up still operating properly despite the fact that it's had some serious malfunction.
A better system than it was before.
Yeah. That can be done if you anticipate the need for that from the beginning.
My guest today is Peter Neumann, principal scientist in the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International and author of the column Inside Risks. This is Tech Nation, Americans in Technology, and I'm Dr. Moira Gunn. Let's go to that example you were just talking about in Tehran. What went wrong? The Patriot system was working great. An incoming Scud landed on the barracks of GIs.
Well, this is a difficult problem. If you try to place the blame in one place, you find that you can't do it. The blame can be distributed, if in fact you're going to assign blame at all. There was, for example, a government statement that about 95% of the Patriots succeeded in destroying their targets. There was a later study at MIT which claimed that something of the order of 13% actually hit their targets. That was done by Ted Postol at MIT. And so there's a great deal of controversy in the Patriot case as to what actually happened. We still don't really know what went on. But if you try to put the blame anywhere, you can say, well, maybe the 14-hour requirement was a bad thing. That was awfully short-sighted. You can say that whoever designed the software for the clock didn't do a very good job.
And why?
Because it drifted. The clock after 100 hours, which was the case on the Dachan barracks destruction, the clock had drifted so substantially that the Patriot system was no longer tracking the missiles in the appropriate frame of reference that it was using. So there was a very serious problem in the clock. Now, you can say, well, maybe the design was okay, but the implementation was wrong because there was a mistake made in the program where there were two different representations of the same number, say 0.1, which in various representations might not be identical. And the software actually relied on the fact that it was the same number, even though it didn't compare as being the same number. And so the clock was sort of wandering off the mark as time went on.
Well, yeah, let me just interject here. In terms of a clock, I mean, my perception of this is that if your clock is right, you're looking at where an incoming scud is at one point in time mm-hmm. and where it is at another point in time.
Right.
And from that, you can track how fast is it moving and what is its trajectory.
Yes, but
well,
you can also...
if you're looking at the clock and it's not, those aren't the right times, you're going to project it's going to be at another place.
Yeah, it's worse than that. If the difference between two times is not close enough to reality, then you are no longer able to track the incoming missile.
So that if they had simply turned the Patriot systems off and reset them and turned them on again,
that
then they might have been all right.
Yeah, that would have helped. But there are other problems as well. And as I say, when you start to assign blame, a lot of these systems are built in a great rush or under circumstances where they don't really have the freedom to do it right. They have to do something quick and dirty to get it going, and then you tend to use that system and modify it a little bit and fix it and then add new functionality to it so that suddenly you're trying to do much more than it was than you'd originally conceived it.
You know, and I'm very aware of your using the words assigning blame, because quite often when an engineering system has a problem, I mean, there are things we can't change, how fast a human responds and how fast a human can read and what they can look at. But quite often we can change the core of an engineering system. And too many times I've seen there be a problem, and it's now time to sit down with the engineering group and say, gosh, what went wrong? And then people say, well, there's no point in assigning blame. We don't want anybody feeling bad about that. We've lost the opportunity to learn from the failure. So we really do need, in general, some words here to say we're not looking for blame. We're not looking to pin it down. But if there's something we can do in the technology process, let's find it and not only fix it here, but see if there's a general methodology that we can use to improve it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good comment. If we go back to the Hubble telescope, for example, if there had been an overall end-to-end test of the entire system, that problem with the lens would have been detected immediately. On the other hand, that's a very expensive process. And in engineering, one is always making compromises and trying to take shortcuts that one thinks are still safe or reasonable or sound or whatever. And so it's not always possible to even do the kinds of testing that you'd like to see. There are a lot of environments, the original Star Wars concept, for example, had to work correctly the first time it was ever deployed in an environment where it could never be tested completely. There could be no end-to-end testing of the system. And I think that kind of a system is very risky. It's extremely difficult to know that everything is going to go right. And in fact, the experience of the past says that things are going to go wrong. And Murphy is, of course, known to everybody, but it's very, very valid. And if you plan a computerization effort around the assumption that things are going to go well, you're probably in serious trouble.
You know, this does remind me, as we're looking at these systems from a global or a larger level, that some systems basically stand on their own. We have no experience of like systems, but that quite often, as systems are going from either similar type systems or successive generations of systems, that we can, in fact, carry with them some of that experience that's there. An example would be, listeners of this show would have remembered, we spoke with the U.S. Amateur Boxing Association, and if you will remember, we had some American boxers who were shoo-ins for gold medals in Barcelona, and they had a brand new Olympic scoring system, and it didn't work. And in subsequent discussions with them, and they're saying, gosh, how do we find out if it works? How do we figure it out? One of the things that came up is, why don't we take, over the years, the raw data of people pushing buttons, and we know what the answer ought to be, and we'll accumulate the experience of boxing matches in the past, because that's how people box and that's how people record. So when we have a new system or a minor change to an old system, a software change that could throw the whole algorithm off, we'll feed in our official set of raw data that says, here's all the old boxing matches, how do you score it?
Yeah.
And you at least know that those kinds of situations, while you haven't hit the whole realm, will be tested. And when you encounter a new one, you can incorporate that as part of your base of knowledge.
It would be nice to believe that one could always do things by hand in a particular situation, and certainly in that case one could. On the other hand, there are a lot of situations where you simply cannot do it by hand. The complexity is too great. But I think there is a deeper problem, and that is when you design systems like this, you have to come up with a human interface that is, in fact, oriented toward the people who are going to be using it. There was a case of getting back to your boxing analogy, of an ice skating case where the judge actually entered the wrong score, something like 4.1 instead of 5.1. Yeah. And there was nothing in the system that permitted that to be corrected, and short of international protest, basically. And so it was simply ignored. But systems should be designed in such a way that you can overcome some of the human error. And in fact, we see that if you include all of the errors in requirements, errors in design, errors in code, those are all human errors. But it's the operational errors are that are ones that that kill you unless there's some way of backing off. Now, in banking systems, usually you can, if you have an erroneous transaction, you can back it out and undo it in some way. Not always, but in many cases you can. In life-critical systems, it doesn't work that way. Once you killed somebody, it's all over.
There's no retry. In the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated category, is this still really happening?
That's a good question. Perhaps the incidence of certain types of problems is diminishing. On the other hand, the incidence of other kinds of problems is increasing. So it really depends on where you look. If you look at malicious hacking activity, for example, in some cases it's diminishing, in other cases it's increasing. If you look at financial fraud, certain types of it seem to be diminishing, other types seem to be increasing. So I think it's very misleading to try and give statistical results about whether this problem is getting worse or better. I think the answer is yes, it's getting worse and it's getting better. And
if it's you, it's getting worse.
Not necessarily.
If it's somebody else, it's probably getting better.
There are aspects of it that are really awful. And there are others that really have improved over the years.
My guest today is Peter Neumann, Principal Scientist at the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International and author of the column Inside Risks. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. Peter, first columns, your early columns, primarily reported failures that have occurred and are of general interest. And over time, you began to discuss issues which surround technology. One that is of real interest to me is you discuss the issue of trust. Who should you trust to do what?
Well, basically, we are implicitly trusting a lot of people to do a lot of things. We're trusting the people who set up the requirements. We're trusting the people who design the system, who implement it, and who operate it. And in some cases, we're trusting the users. Now, in some cases, that trust is totally misplaced. If you build a system and you assume that everybody is honest, you may have some
problems,
surprises. Now, we have to assume somehow that there are some trustworthy people along the way. But if we design systems such that everybody has to be trusted, we're in real trouble. So the problem then becomes to design things in such a way that the trust can be distributed around so that you're not trusting everybody with everything. And in fact, you are giving only a sort of a piece of the trust to certain individuals. Banks recognized this long ago. You don't have one person who can do absolutely anything in the bank. You divide up the responsibilities. You don't have somebody who can authorize a transaction, take out all the money, and have no accountability for it. The real question here is one of accountability. And most of the computer systems today don't have very good accountability. You can't look at it afterwards and say what happened and know what did happen. There's one comment I can make here that relates to the trustworthiness of the underlying system. There's a magnificent example of Ken Thompson's in modifying a compiler in such a way that the next time that compiler was used to recompile the system, there would be a trapdoor installed in the login routine, which would give someone who knew about it essentially unlimited access to the system. Now, this example is absolutely beautiful because it shows that even if you trust all of the code in the original system, this is an example of a Trojan horse that totally undermines all of the security that was in the original system. And yet there was no change, the way this was installed, to any of the source code for the system itself. And this is a miraculously beautiful example of how one could compromise a system completely without there being essentially any evidence that it had happened.
You have observed a growing disillusionment with technology, and in your most recent column, you literally switch the glaring focus off technology itself and onto the interaction between human beings. And having read many of your columns, frankly, it was as if you had a revelation about how we should view technology. Would you talk about that?
In the most recent column, I looked at a book that Jerry Mander has written, which is titled In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. It's a Sierra Club book. It's a rather extraordinary book. And let's not talk about the sacred part of it. Let's talk about the technology part of it. He makes some very, very strong arguments about essentially looking the gift horse in the mouth. Technology is not a gift horse. In fact, maybe it's a Trojan horse. And what he suggests is that it would be very important to consider whether the use of technology is justified, or whether it's sound, or whether it makes any sense, or whether it is in fact undermining in some broad sense the civilization pretending to protect or to help. And I think the issue here is that people often say, well, technology is not intrinsically evil or intrinsically good. It's neutral. And I think Jerry Mander's book makes the point that it is inherently evil in the sense that it is so widely misused that its mere existence is more of a problem than it is a blessing. I have a great deal of sympathy for the view that says one must be extremely cautious in using technology. And yet, I'm a technologist, and I derive my livelihood out of trying to build better systems or to design better systems or to evaluate systems to see how good they are and how well they meet their requirements. And the conclusion I come to is that, as we started out earlier, there are no guarantees that the system will ever do the right thing, and therefore we really need to be much more circumspect in applying computer technology and other related technologies in our daily lives, as well as in our the preservation of our civilization, basically. Cut on the backside is that we may be making things much worse for ourselves rather than improving our lives.
Moira's guest has been Peter Neumann, principal scientist in the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International and author of the monthly column Inside Risks. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of Mogo Tech Media.
This is Internet Talk Radio. You may copy these files and change the encoding format, but may not alter the content or resell the programs. You can send us mail to mail@radio.com.